Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
The 2%'s right over here.
Oh, hey, Jenna. I didn't know you shopped here.
Yeah. Anything to support local food, know what I mean?
I definitely do. Though that's not the only thing you do in the name of Good Eats, obviously.
Well, true. I also host Eating Matters every Wednesday at 5 p.m., where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. Be sure to tune in.
All right, yeah, gotta get the plug in there. I get it.
Yep, I'm hashtag shameless.
You know what else you can do to support the local food community, right?
Well, yeah. Make a donation to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station.
That's right. And I gotta call you out on the whole local thing.
What do you mean?
Well, The Farm Report, A Taste of the Past, Japan Eats. Those are shows that take you around the country and the world.
I'll give you that. So how can listeners give their support?
It's pretty easy. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the big red heart in the top right corner. It's pretty easy from there.
Thanks.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Funeral Food by Lake Ryder. Eating to comfort sorrow, ease the queasiness of death, atavistic need to feed against the darkness. Funeral foods, a cookbook category. Soothing dishes laden with fat, concocted with tears, borrowed from ancestors, always at the ready. That's Funeral Food by Lake Ryder from her blog post, Colder by the Lake. And funeral food is so much more. Interesting customs that we'll talk about with Sarah Lohman today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this journey through culinary history. And yes, it's a bit of the macabre to talk about funeral food, I suppose. Well, wait till you hear some of the customs and some of the historic things we've dug up. But indeed, funeral food is a category unto itself and in a cookbook category. And it's been in the news recently for some people, particularly in the East Coast. I don't know if anyone's managed to catch some of the articles, but you know, there are around 7 or 8 states that still forbid any food in funeral homes, but the states are recently overturning that, realizing that people are on their feet standing at a wake for many, many hours, and they need a little coffee or sustenance, cake. Coffee, cake, cookies. We've got some information, some things you might not be expecting today. My guest is Sarah Lohman, and Sarah is an historic gastronomist. We'll ask her about that. Historic gastronomist. She recreates historic recipes as a way to make a personal connection with the past, as well as to inspire her contemporary cooking. She has a very interesting blog post called 4 Pounds Flour, and podcasts, MSG podcasts. We'll talk about those too. And she has a book coming out in December called 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Linda.
You're no stranger. You've been here a couple times. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah. No, I've been back a couple times, and I'm sure I'll be back a couple more too.
Well, and your topics range all across the board. What in the world made you start looking at funeral food?
Well, it actually has a connection to the reason I got started working in historic food. My very first job in high school is I worked at a living history museum, which if any listeners, if you've been to Coney Williamsburg or Plymouth Plantation, it was like that, but we were doing Western Reserve Ohio history. So 1848 was the year. And every year, the household that I worked in, I was in costume and character at 16 years old, we did a funeral reenactment, and we wanted it to be something very real from the 19th century, so we did a child's funeral. And I did that two summers in a row, that particular funeral reenactment, and the memory is so visceral to me. It's there are certain sort of smells and flavors that I can't now separate from this idea of mourning, particularly rosemary, which is traditionally a smell used to hide the scent of decay, and also caraway, which in the 19th century in America, it was rather traditional to pass out shortbread cookies that were often flavored with caraway seeds. So I have these very, very strong associations with it. Later on, as I began my career in working with historic food full-time, these sort of ideas of what we do at funerals began to connect with me. I had this experience in the past, but I've been to funerals now. My first one when I was 8, when my grandfather passed away. And I remember sitting in the funeral home basement in Ohio, and, you know, there's cold cuts and bread. And I remember thinking, how can people eat right now? And just those two ideas, the past and the present, made me wonder why food has such a strong association with funerals. And then I was amazed to find that there's been very, very little scholarly work looking into it. There's no one book that looks at the entire history of food and funerals. So the research I've done is really just scratching the surface, often pulling from other articles, other books, other sources, and oral histories too. So I am, in a way, by no means, I would call the preeminent scholar on funeral food history, but maybe one day I will be, because the work is not out there. And to me, well, not just to me. I've gotten so many requests to talk about this topic. It's fascinating to a lot of people.
Right. Well, and the fact that the custom of eating and drinking at funerals or some type of food-related activity dates back as far as history has ever been recorded, and heavily in the medieval period, particularly.
Yeah. And probably even prehistory, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. From what people can gather from the bones and detritus left in around the burial sites. It's very... very interesting. So let's delve into
the history. Let's do it.
If we want to, I mean, there you said the caraway seeds and the biscuits, and of course, not a lot of scholarly work. In doing some of my background research, just so I knew what to talk about and ask you a question about, I noticed most, you're right, most everything are these postings on people's blogs and sites, but yes, there's a lot of background and history on the cakes, the funeral cakes and the funeral biscuits and cookies, but a lot of the other activities, not so much.
Right.
And this goes back, I mean, back to, I guess we could talk pre-sin eaters, and sin eaters is an interesting topic as well.
Too.
Yeah.
Well, if we go all the way back to the beginning, I look at the evolution of funeral food like this, that in the beginning, some anthropologists believe that it was an actual physical consumption of the body, and we can talk more about that, too.
That's alleged, remember.
Alleged, yeah. But we can also look, but some of those, that has continued through to modern hunter-gatherer cultures in several regions. Up through the 19th, maybe even the early 20th century, we have sort of a modern counterpart for cannibalism, what's known as endocannibalism, which is eating someone within your community for various reasons. From that, it transitions to leaving food offerings for the dead to give nourishment in the spiritual world. And we have documentation of that in Egypt back 4,000 years ago. But even before that, we find food leavings in grave sites. And then it transitions to it being food for the living, in basically because you start traveling to a place for the funeral, people are living further apart, and you need to nourish both the people and the animals, the horses that brought them there. So then we get into this idea of a funeral feast, which in a way, in the modern day, is still what we're doing. This, it's a feast for the living, not for the dead, to nourish the people that are mourning.
All right. The cannibalistic activities in the Paleolithic period, I mean, you know, there's a lot. Cannibalism was a part of our background in a way. So I'm sure that it did exist, but
yeah,
not to dwell on that too much. But it was sort of like to carry. Wouldn't they believe they would carry that with them?
Different societies believe different things, and I should say that there are two types of cannibalism. There's exocannibalism, which is revenge cannibalism, or in some way you consume your enemies to consume their power as mm-hmm. well. Endocannibalism, as I mentioned, is when it's within the community, and it was practiced into the modern era in Australia, in the Amazon, and in Papua New Guinea. We're talking at least 19th century bicultures within these regions. In the Amazon, it was to bring an end to grieving. The idea was that consumption of the physical body helps you break the bonds with the spiritual person and to understand they aren't anymore. In Australia, it was this idea of respecting the dead too. And in Papua New Guinea, it was the idea of taking on the positive aspects of the person who is deceased by consuming parts of the people who have deceased. Now, there were results of this too, especially in Papua New Guinea. There was a disease called laughing sickness that is passed on by the consumption of human brains. The last case of that died out fairly recently in the late 20th century.
Is that the one that was similar to mad cow disease?
Yeah, a little bit, but in humans. Mm. And it was all passed through women, and the symptoms wouldn't show up until 10 years later. So there are also reasons in modern society that we don't eat both humans and primates, because it's very, very easy to pass along very deadly diseases that way. But traditionally, it had this very important and powerful spiritual meaning. And looking at these modern societies that have other things in common with prehistoric humans, we can look at that too and say that this is probably something that was occurring back in our prehistory as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, particularly the English, which also then was, you know, a lot of the customs passed on to the colonies, mm-hmm. the American colonies. In the medieval times, there were the sin eaters, as they would call them, but a couple different ways that evolved. Can you talk about that?
I think that's a really interesting link in a modern Christian society. So sin eating seemed to have, no one is quite sure where it evolved, but it was happening primarily in Ireland and other parts of the UK from the 17th century through the 19th century. And the idea was, if it started as if someone died suddenly, there's this fear that this person will go to purgatory and won't get to move on to heaven. But then eventually they used this practice no matter what. And the sin eater was a person within a community, although he was somewhat ostracized by that community, that was hired in a way to eat the sins of the deceased person. And this was done in several ways, in several accounts I've read. Either the sin eater was passed as a piece of bread or a jug of beer over the corpse that they would then eat. In some cases, the bread is sitting on the chest of the deceased. And in other cases, I've read that maybe exaggerations, the sin eater actually sits or crouches over the deceased while he's eating. And it's this combination, it's religious magic is often how it's referred, where it's grounded in accepted religious belief, but then in local communities, there are these sort of magical properties that are also put on. It's the same way that someone who's Christian might also believe in a four-leaf clover, or someone who is Jewish might also believe in the evil eye. They're not part of that tradition, but there's something else.
Right.
So the idea was that the bread and the beer was imbued with these persons' earthly sins. The sin eater would consume them and then would be paid some money for taking on those sins. And then the person who is dead, the family member, could then move on to heaven. But then the person who had taken on these sins, usually, although not always, was then seen as a rather kind of foul and corrupt person. So it was usually someone who was on the fringes of society already. There's some accounts that say this tradition continued in Appalachia, in America, into the 19th and maybe early 20th century. But yeah, you can see this connection between the bread. Bread throughout funeral histories actually represented the human body, mm-hmm. Both
well,
the physical and the spiritual.
How about at communion and religious services, the
exactly.
body of Christ? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it seems that bread and body connection doesn't necessarily come from that Catholic tradition, that it predates that. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic tradition came from what was already there, that bread could represent. Instead of eating the physical body, you were then eating this representation of it, and that was doing the same things. There's a wonderful tradition in Eastern Europe, and I think in Germany too, where when someone has died, they make bread and then rest it on the chest of the deceased to rise.
Right.
And the idea is that as it's rising, it's taking in those positive aspects of the person who is deceased. Then it's baked and served at the funeral, and that's your way to be able to pass on.
And take that person's positive energy
with you,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's also interesting the sort of nuances in what this bread can represent, that it can be sin in one culture and it can be the spirit in another.
That's right. It's so interesting because it goes from people, you know, wanting to eat this bread or vice versa,
yeah,
to the, you know, to, as you say, the sin eater. Salt was often involved too,
yeah,
right? Put salt and bread on the body, and then the sin eater would come in.
Exactly. And sometimes, particularly at Irish wakes too, it wasn't bread. It was like a pinch of salt or even a pinch of tobacco too that was set on the chest of the deceased too. So there was, throughout history, up until really the 20th century, there was almost this direct physical connection with the body, and this connection had to do with consumption as well.
Interesting. And, you know, it was, whether it was religious, you know, spiritual, obviously spiritual. Then when formed religion and services came in, this was often in conflict with people's religions. And so it was, you know, they would kind of looked upon as heathens,
yeah,
for practicing this.
Established religious tradition does not like the idea of religious magic, because,
yeah,
religious magic puts power into the individuals. And so, you know, we're talking 19th century and before, that is not what any sort of established religion wants. They want you to go to the church. So particularly amongst the Irish that had such strong traditions before Catholicism showed up, things like sin eating were integrated into Catholic tradition, but the Catholic Church also hated these sort of independent traditions of the Irish that persisted, and really in a lot of those traditions still persist in certain ways to this day, and they've become more accepted.
Right. There was something back even, I mean, I know that a lot of the sin eating custom in one form or another existed in the 14th century for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But there back, even back, the Egyptians had things that they would do, the triangular loaf.
Yeah, so the Egyptians, so if we're talking about, we have this prehistory idea of actually consuming the body, the first transition was into leaving spiritual nourishment for the dead. And this probably goes back to before the Egyptians, but there is an amazing photograph online of a 4,000-year-old piece of bread. And this was left as really a temple offering in the corner of a period of a burial site. But in Egyptian burial sites, you find all kinds of things like cake, like grain, like wine, like beer, like even cuts of meat too. And then the idea was when that food ran out, the paintings that you see on the wall, the hieroglyphics, are often food oriented, not just the hieroglyphics, but the images, the paintings themselves. So once the physical food runs out for the deceased, then they have this representative food that will turn into real food in the afterlife.
So they should not be hungry. They will have food.
Exactly. All kinds of stuff. Right.
And then, of course, we transition to more, not modern times, but I mean, let's say early 19th century, late 18th century. The idea of eating cake or biscuits,
right,
you know, cake and coffee,
right,
at a wake, it goes back a long time, right?
Right. And there's even this transition point about 1,500 years ago. They opened up King Midas's tomb in the middle of the 20th century. He's a real guy, King Midas. And what they discovered was that there had been a big meal right before they sealed up the tomb. Midas is there. Everyone had a big meal of lentils and goat and this sort of wine beer concoction. And then they left the dirty bowls and sealed up the tomb. So this was a transition point between, that was a meal for Midas, but as opposed to just leaving it with him, it was consumed on site. Yeah. And so that's really the transition between that older era and this modern era of food being for the living. And we see that, yes, beginning in late Middle Ages with this idea of Averil. Averil is Old English for heir's ale. So it was a celebration, in this case, for someone living, that it was the person who was going to inherit the seat of whoever who had departed. So this is obviously associated with lords and people who owed land.
Mm-hmm.
So that firstborn son, the oldest son, he's gonna inherit everything. So it's really a toast with beer, and then Averil began to refer to bread that was served when someone departed. First at these very, very high-end ones, but then even at the most simplest, plainest funerals, there were always bread and beer. And if you could afford it, this Avril bread was, it's called cake sometimes, but it's not cake in our modern sense of the word. It was a sweetened, yeasted bread.
Might have had some fruits.
Absolutely,
dried fruits
in it, often spiced, again, if you could afford it, things like saffron, things like cinnamon. So it was this kind of sweet, pleasant cake, too. So that that continued that idea of the body and the bread in the Middle Ages.
Interesting. Well, things then continued to develop, and we're going to hear more about it going on to dinners, feasts, and present-day customs when we come back after a short break.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Sarah Lohman, historic gastronomist. We're talking about funeral food. Yes, the happy and the weird.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And the soothing.
And the soothing. Yeah. Well, as the poem I read at the top of the show, you know, there are a lot of reasons you say, well, how could people eat? You know, you as a little girl, you said, well, how could people eat at a time like this? And yet, after a while, some people do forget to eat because they're so distraught. And people bring, what do they bring? Casseroles to the house. They bring all kinds of, you know, dishes of food that sometimes goes untouched. Sometimes if your freezer's big enough, it fills up the freezer, right?
And then the idea of sitting Shiva, too. Right. Traditionally, it's the people who are in attendance at Shiva that should prepare and put food in your hands. And it's really that idea of, you know, you're too sad to be able to take care of yourself, so let us take care of you now.
That's right. We left off somewhere between the medieval period and the Renaissance, but there were all kinds of interesting dinners and feasts that would occur.
Yeah,
right?
So we've got people eating bread, but then these these funerals, particularly if it was someone who was a big landowner, a big lord, turned into enormous feasts. I've got a couple historic accounts that I want to read. I think are interesting to give you an example. This is from Avril, so a funeral feast in 1309, and here's what was served or what was used in the couple days that the guests were there mourning the deceased. 1.5 butts of cider, 5 pigs, 1 hare, 5 sheep, 13 hens, 19 geese, 1.5 gallons of oysters, 2 hogs, 9 capons, 1.5 carcasses of beef, 4 bacons besides wine, ale, eggs, and bread given to the poor and friends, and a fee of 66 shillings and 8 pence to the chaplain. 50 pounds of wax was also used, presumably for candles. So they can really be several-day affairs because people are now traveling from far away.
And it sounds like the whole town came to the castle or something.
Yeah, and it's really to show off the power of this family, too.
Right.
But
then
on the other hand, I've got this one from the 17th century, and it's from a diary of an Avril in 1673, which the author considered, quote unquote, rather shabby, because all he got was nothing but a bit of cheese, a draft of wine, a piece of rosemary, and a pair of gloves. So he was like not happy with the food that he got. And by then, the 17th century, there's also this expectation of souvenirs. You might get a piece of rosemary, you might get a flower, you might get gloves, you might get a handkerchief, or you might get a cookie, as we would call them in America, or a cake wrapped in a very special wrapping, too.
Mm-hmm. And these wrappings were often, if they, well, in later times, they would be black tissue paper. But in those times, they would often be printed pieces of paper.
Yeah. So this is a tradition that is in England and in America in the 18th and 19th century, and they're called funeral biscuits. And the tradition has been rather hard to pin down because although recipes for these cakes appear in cookbooks from the 18th and 19th century, they're often not labeled as such. They might just be labeled caraway cakes. So you have to know what you're looking for. Sometimes in written documents, in handwritten recipe books, they might be labeled funeral cakes. Mm-hmm. And they're often flavored with caraway, sometimes with orange, sometimes with ginger, sometimes with molasses, too. Early on, they would have been made at home, perhaps by a family member of the deceased. But by the middle of the 19th century, you could order them out from bakeries who advertised that they could make you funeral biscuits at a moment's notice. And you could pick out poems or pictures or Bible verses or have the name and date of the departed, too. And these would be printed on the wrappers. And they'd be sealed up with black wax.
Black wax, yes.
These were known here in New Amsterdam as doodkoeks, as death cakes. Exactly.
Yeah, death cakes. Exactly. The Dutch were so much the influence of our baking in this country.
Really, yeah. They really brought a lot of delicious things, and one of those is cookies.
Dot cookies.
Exactly. Yeah. So these come from, the words literally mean death cakes. And in some contexts, it seems like they mean to be eaten. In others, they were these really big, elaborately stamped cookies, too. They weren't cut. They had special stamps with symbolic meanings, like a rose was often used for a child. A rooster was used sometimes to symbolize rebirth. Crosses and hearts were popular themes as well. And so the cookies were molded in these. And then they were these very kind of hard, dense shortbread cookies that you could eat or you could take home. And they were this memento mori of the occasion and the departed.
Yeah. Well, prayer cards are a little easier and they'd take those home. Interesting. So what about, I know there are a lot of people who have special recipes. As the poem I read referred to, it's a category in cookbooks, funeral mm-hmm. foods. Mm-hmm. There are specific foods that, you know, as I mentioned casseroles before, that are particularly served at funerals.
Yeah, I think the most famous one in the modern era is known as Mormon funeral potatoes, which I think is rather marvelous and has a marvelous story. They're so famous in Utah that when the Olympics were held in Salt Lake City, they released a sort of commemorative pins of Utah culture and history, and one of them was a casserole of Mormon funeral potatoes. So they're absolutely iconic out west. And what they are is, horrible and delicious. They're frozen hash browns mixed with cream of chicken or mushroom, I can't remember, soup. And
oh, we'll hear about it. If you can't remember exactly, we'll hear about it.
Cheese and like a crunchy crust on top, and then you bake it. So it's just super fatty and salty and soothing.
I think Wisconsin calls those cheesy potatoes.
Cheesy potatoes. Right. And when I've served them at talks too, people are like, oh, my mom would make these for Thanksgiving.
Right.
So they appear in other places. They're pretty basic casserole, but the reason they're so famous in a way in Utah is because Mormon culture is so focused on community. And so they even have these sort of like casserole commissions where there's people that band together that when a family is in need or has experienced a death, like they show up at your door with casseroles. Mm-hmm. So it comes from this taking care of each other culture that's an important part of Mormonism that results in casseroles and then resulted in this particular casserole, which I read a great quote online where someone said, if you know they aren't served and they aren't served the right way at my funeral, I'm going to come back and haunt you as a ghost, which I think is great.
Right. Yeah. Well, indeed, the religious traditions took over, but there are, particularly in, I think in the Protestant religions, there are the church ladies' guilds, and mm-hmm. they were always assigned, you know, and the churches had these big kitchens, so they were always assigned with making lots of casseroles. As soon as they knew that somebody in the community died, they'd all gather at the church, these, you know, the ladies, and of course the ladies, and
right.
cook the casseroles.
Right.
I had read somewhere, I don't know if you have run across it at all, something about, you know, when funeral homes then took over, you know, the wakes were always held in the home.
Right.
And then when funeral homes came into being, the wife of the funeral director, mm. the funeral director was a man, mm. the wife would bake bread and bring it to the family? I don't know if you've ever
not necessarily heard that, but I think that the transition between death in the home and death in a funeral home is a very interesting one, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even just saying that, you know, that is something that I already mentioned was done by family members of the deceased. And now even this idea of the bread baking, you know, seems to be going to the funeral director. A lot of that transition really happened in places like New York City. New York was a big one. We live in small apartments here, and so whereas traditionally for all the hundreds if not thousands of years past, people were sick and died and were mourned in their homes, now people didn't necessarily have room to have that sort of funeral celebration event in their home. So it's in places like New York that we see the rise of the funeral home, a place that you can rent out essentially to have that same celebration. And it was also people, you know, see us as being very detached from death in the 21st century. But I look at it as we've arrived where we are because of everything that's happened in the past. Doing those events in your home was very difficult. You know, having a loved one pass away in your home is difficult, mourning them there. And often what that meant for people who had houses and fine parlors where those events would take place, instead of being a room where joy could be experienced, they were a continuing memorial to the people that had departed and a continual reminder. And it also seems that that was just very hard for people. And so they were relieved to be able to move that out of their private space and put it in a more public space, and it was easier for them to move on in the mourning process. Now, I have read the story might be apocryphal, but at the same time, it makes sense that the term living room, instead of calling that room the parlor, comes from the fact, and I've seen a reference for it, I have to dig up, it was like Ladies Home Journal. They said that now this is a room that we can live in, so let us call it the living room. So it was that removal of the culture of death from the home.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and then it's interesting that at a certain point in time, and I'm not sure when it occurred, that food was banned from these funeral homes.
Yeah, which is such a funny thing.
Well, there were reasons. The reasons were that they said it was in direct competition with the restaurants nearby, because I guess after the wake, after the funeral, everyone would depart and go to these restaurants and have their feasts. And also there was the fear of bugs and disease.
Right.
So that has been...
As we got into this very modern hygienic era. Yeah.
So it's just last month that Massachusetts, I guess, just passed that food could be brought in. And of course, then, you know, they're wondering on how much, to what extreme, and do you do just, you know, coffee and cake and feast? No alcohol is still in many of them, because we know some of those Irish wakes could get pretty
That's something
rowdy.
Else that the Catholics had a problem with, too. The Catholic Church didn't like the Irish wakes, but they were, Irish tradition tends to be more around having a drink with everyone than it did to be with eating with everyone. It was just a way to mourn. Yeah. You know, it's funny, when I talk about this in public and I talk about this topic with classes, I often end by mentioning that there are funeral homes, particularly in the South, and one in Texas, I believe, that one funeral home invited Starbucks to open up a chain within their funeral home. Right. And it didn't work out. I double-checked online. I followed up, and they have their own coffee house that's open to the public at any time within the boundaries of their funeral home. And students, they're kind of freaked out by that. They think it's so strange. But the funeral director's point was people want a place to not be in that funeral space. The directors want a place to meet that's comfortable. People need something nourishing, something comforting, something familiar. And so why not have that within the space? Maybe we have come to a point where we have now become too removed from death that we can't even understand what someone who's going through the process of mourning might need. And that's exactly what a funeral director knows.
Well, with the removal of the bans of food, I'm sure you're going to see, you know, more coffee shop, things like that opening up in there. And of course, the tradition of feasts, if you want to call them feasts, but large dinners, because families, you say people travel, families get together, and then, then the wake, the burial, it's over. And what do? You're together with all the family. Mm. You have to eat. So it turns into a large dinner, call it a feast, if you will.
I mean,
it's, you know, and certainly celebrating good memories.
Right. Exactly.
Once the sins have been eaten and taken away.
Right, exactly. Right. And this, the fact of having food there, it's still this really interesting symbolism of not just spiritual nourishment for you and the departed, and also this idea of this consumption, the body and the blood, and all of that strong religious symbolism is there even in our not religious society.
Right. Interesting material. And as I say, I was astounded by how many, you know, like random facts I could find.
Yeah.
As you say, no great scholarly work. I'm sure we can dig in and find something that someone has written about. But here you go, folks, students looking for a dissertation.
Seriously.
This could be an interesting topic.
There's been a couple essays. There's a couple chapters. There's resources from the 19th century that I've been able to pull quotes from and things like that.
And recipes.
Exactly. But especially in the last 200 years, a lot of it is very sort of sketchy, modern, oral tradition. So it would be really nice for someone, grad students out there, scholars, to really track all this information down and do a comprehensive history of funeral food. I think it's valuable, and I just don't think it's something, much like food history in general, as you know, Linda, only very recently has become accepted as scholarly research.
Right.
And I still get young men and women coming to me and saying, you know, I'm an anthropologist, I'm a historian, I want to work in food, and my department is not letting me. So it's there's still a little bit of a fight, I think, to get this as... But to me, food is so powerful and so telling of who we are as humans. So I think, honestly, the reason there has not been a scholarly document yet is because it's not an accepted topic. It's taboo in many, many ways.
With death in particular, yes, it is. Sarah, always interesting.
Thank you.
Always informed.
Thank you
so much for joining me. And thanks for listening to A Taste of the Past. And I want to remind our listeners that Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported radio station, and we are a 501c3. So if you like what you hear, and we have so many programs on our website, just look and see. Go to the website at heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart. We need your help. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.